BBC World Service, it's 2 o'clock GMT. This is Ritula Shah with continuing coverage of the crisis in Iraq. American commanders say it's been the toughest day of fighting since the war in Iraq began. There's been particularly fierce fighting around the strategically important town of Nasiriyah. As news of the clashes came in, President Bush emerged to address reporters. He warned Iraqis to treat American prisoners of war humanely and said he was confident that the campaign was going well. We'll be going live to the Gulf for the latest from the battlefronts. And the Iraqi foreign minister tells this programme that the Arab world is rallying to the Iraqi cause.
The position of the Arabs is unified. The people, the Arab people all over the Arab world are unified behind Iraq. They are supporting Iraq. They are indignant and angry against the United States and Britain.
The Iraqi foreign minister, one of the voices we'll be hearing. But first, the world news.
BBC News with Mary Small. The deputy commander of American forces in Iraq says they've had their toughest day of fighting so far, with up to 10 Marines killed at Nasiriyah and 12 soldiers missing or taken prisoner. Lieutenant General John Abizay told a briefing at Central Command in Qatar that the sharpest engagement so far had been at Nasiriyah. Our correspondent Michael Voss was there.
This was the first public appearance of Lieutenant General John Abizay. In his briefing, he acknowledged that US and British troops had faced a tough day of resistance. Dangerous to those in the field, he said, but not to the outcome of the mission. He described the campaign as on track and predicted that his forces would soon arrive in the vicinity of Baghdad. This has been a day of mounting American casualties. According to General Abizay, some 10 Marines were killed in fighting near Nasiriyah. In a separate incident, a supply convoy of 6 vehicles was ambushed by Iraqi troops. By the time Marine reinforcements arrived, 12 soldiers from the convoy were missing. It's feared that these could be the dead and prisoners shown on Iraqi television.
In Baghdad, air raids have taken place for a fourth night. Several big explosions rocked the city centre. Reporters said there was no warning or any sign of defensive anti-aircraft fire. President Bush has warned Iraqi leaders that anyone who mistreats American prisoners of war will be regarded as a war criminal. Mr. Bush condemned the showing by Iraqi state television of the interrogation of several captured Americans. President Bush said he expected American prisoners to be treated humanely, just as U.S. forces would treat Iraqis whom they captured. The Iraqi Minister of Defense, Sultan Hashim Ahmed, said prisoners of war would not be harmed. Reports from Washington say American forces in Iraq have reached a chemical plant south of the capital, Baghdad. An American television station quoted Pentagon officials as saying that American troops were in control of the site near the town of Najaf and were investigating if there were any chemical weapons there. Military officials at the United States Central Command in Qatar told the BBC that American troops were looking at a number of sites of potential interest in northern Iraq. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, says the campaign to oust Saddam Hussein's regime is going to plan, despite a number of accidents in which British servicemen have died. His comments came after it was confirmed that the 2-man crew of a Royal Air Force plane had died when their aircraft was shot down by an American missile. 14 British servicemen were killed in 2 earlier helicopter accidents. In a broadcast to British forces, Mr. Blair praised the conduct of the armed forces.
These things are never easy. There will be some tough times ahead. But it is going to plan, despite the tragedies that have occurred. And once again, we have to thank and take pride in the professionalism, the skill and the courage of our armed forces, who are helping making this country, our world, more secure, and also liberating the Iraqi people from one of the most brutal dictatorships of modern times.
The Iraqi Foreign Minister Naji Sabri has told the BBC that American and British troops will be defeated. He said the entire Arab world is unified in its anger against America and Britain. Mr. Sabri is in Cairo for a meeting of the Arab League on Monday, at which foreign ministers will try to agree a common position on Iraq. The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has made an address to the nation about the war in Iraq. Mr. Erdogan defended his government's decision to open Turkish airspace to coalition planes and has talked about the need to send Turkish soldiers into northern Iraq. Our correspondent in Turkey, Nick Thorpe, reports.
Mr. Erdogan issued a stirring call for national unity in the face of both the war in Iraq and the deep economic crisis threatening his country. He said Turkey had had no choice but to open its airspace when requested to do so by its ally America. On the highly controversial question of his government's desire to send its troops into northern Iraq, he said they would serve as the guarantee of peace and stability in the region. The Kurds of Iraq stiffly oppose any new Turkish troops crossing the border, and the United States has also warned Turkey not to make any unilateral moves.
The war in Iraq has overshadowed the American film industry's annual awards ceremony, the Oscars, taking place in Hollywood. Police and National Guardsmen have been deployed to forestall anti-war protests, and some actors have decided to stay away because they believe the ceremony will appear frivolous. As one concession this year, the organizers have decided to scrap the traditional red carpet reception. BBC News.
It's 6 minutes past two GMT. This is the BBC World Service with continuing coverage of the conflict in Iraq. I'm Rithula Shah. It's been a day in which things have not all gone the way of the US and British forces, a fact quietly alluded to by President Bush when he spoke to reporters a few hours ago on the lawn of the White House.
It is evident that it's going to take a while to achieve our objective, but we're on course. We're determined, and we're making good progress.
American and British forces are still meeting significant resistance, though, as even US generals admit, and there's no sign of the Iraqi government crumbling. Iraqi Defense Minister Sultan Ahmed Hashim said that as the US and British forces push north, Iraqi forces are awaiting for them in Basra.
Because we are waiting for them in Basra, they haven't been able to achieve anything. Our units will be fighting this enemy from one position to another on the way to Basra.
With US forces taking casualties in the fighting around Nasiriya and with American prisoners of war displayed on Iraqi television, it's been an uncomfortable day for the US military spokesman. One Arabic journalist stood up at a crowded briefing in Qatar and used the V word, Vietnam.
We have been seeing reports of US soldiers killed, missing and captured, and the stiff resistance of Iraqi in many cities which you claimed before taking full control, such as Nasiriya and Umm Qasr. Are you facing a new Vietnam in Iraq, or you are victims of over self-confidence?
War is a very, very risky business for everybody. We're not overconfident about this endeavor. We are confident about the ultimate outcome of this endeavor. There won't be anything that stops us on the battlefield.
That was the US military spokesman, Lieutenant General John Abizaid, speaking at Central Command in Qatar a few hours ago. As American and British forces continue the push forward from the south, the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, has been enduring another night of bombing. Our correspondent Andrew Gilligan described the scene in the city late on Sunday evening.
This evening's been rather limited bombing. We've seen about 11 or 12 large explosions over the last maybe 8 hours, and nothing on the scale of Friday night when there was a continuous bombardment for an hour and a half, 2 hours. We've seen also what seems to have been a successful surface-to-air missile attack by the Iraqis. We saw the SAM go up. We saw it hit something, a mid-air explosion, and then we saw bits of debris coming down. We don't know what it was that it hit. Could have been an unmanned aerial vehicle, could have been a plane, could have been a cruise missile. But shortly afterwards, lots of very excited Iraqi police officers and militiamen were racing actually along the road in front of our hotel to the banks of the Tigris and looking through the rushes and reeds there for what they thought might have been a downed airman. The second time they've done that today.
But nothing, from what you could see, nothing was apparent. They didn't find anything.
No, that's right. All of them then all screeched off in another direction. So maybe they have picked up another trace there. But the whole thing is symptomatic, both this and the earlier search on the banks of the Tigris during the daylight. It's symptomatic of the kind of febrile atmosphere that's starting to grip Baghdad. People are starting to become rather nervous and rather frightened about what's coming and what's already happened.
And from what you can see of the bombings over the last few days, is there a pattern to the buildings which are being hit? Is it just the official buildings still?
Yes, it is, although I have to say I visited part of a residential neighbourhood in which six houses had been more or less completely destroyed by what appeared to be a bomb. There was certainly a crater, a very deep crater filled with water in this place I visited, and the locals told me that 25 people had been killed in that attack. Now, it's possible that might actually be some kind of Iraqi anti-aircraft artillery dropping to the ground in the wrong place, but it's more likely it's a bomb that went astray that didn't meet its target. So although no civilians have been targeted, some have, of course, been killed.
You say there is, in response to all of this, a more febrile atmosphere within the city, but are people still trying to go about their relatively normal lives?
Not really. I mean, in the sense of going, driving the streets and going shopping, no. Those kind of things have basically stopped. A few shops for foodstuffs and that kind of thing are still open, but the vast majority are closed. There's very little traffic on the streets at night, almost none. There's still a certain amount of traffic on the streets during the day, but maybe only about 20% of the normal levels, even though there is still the occasional traffic jam. But basically, as night falls, everyone hurries home in a great, great hurry.
Andrew Gilligan in Baghdad, and of course his movements are restricted by the Iraqi authorities. As American troops continue their advance towards Baghdad, they're meeting determined Iraqi resistance, nowhere more so than in the southern town of Nasiriyah, where there's been some of the fiercest fighting yet and a number of US casualties. The BBC's Andrew North is with a US Marine unit which has been trying to secure the town.
Things are a bit more peaceful in Nasiriyah, although that's a very relative term. The US Marines have taken control of a key strategic route that they were trying to, particularly these two key bridges in the town. But they say they are continuing to receive some kind of Iraqi resistance. They're receiving fire. It's certainly not calm and peaceful in the town, and of course they are now coming to terms with the fact that they've lost at least six confirmed dead and at least 14 injured, and that figure, it's almost certain, is going to rise.
Andrew North, who's near the town of Nasiriyah. Let's look at the main stories. American commanders say they've had their toughest day of fighting since their forces invaded Iraq. They've encountered particularly fierce resistance near the town of Nasiriyah. The British Prime Minister Tony Blair has told British forces that, despite difficulties, the campaign to oust Saddam Hussein is going well. And President Bush has warned the Iraqis not to mistreat American prisoners of war. It's almost 13 minutes past 2 GMT. Well, as we've been hearing, Iraqi television has been broadcasting footage of what it says are several captured US soldiers. In the pictures, the four men and a woman looked clearly tired and nervous. One man who's experienced what it is to be a prisoner of war is John Nicol. He's a former navigator with the British Royal Air Force who was shot down in the last Gulf War and held as a prisoner. He spoke to my colleague Julian Marshall and described his feelings on seeing the pictures of the captured soldiers.
I mean, it's almost impossible to put into words, to be perfectly honest. You know, one sees the pictures of captives, male and female, and sees the terror on their faces. I mean, you said nervous, Julian. I suspect it's decidedly more than nervous, to be perfectly honest. They're in the hands of the enemy, so great fear for them, great worry for them, and of course, most importantly, great fear and worry for their families back home, which sometimes we completely forget about when in the media when we're talking about these things.
So what would you expect to happen to this group?
Well, it's a truly impossible question to answer. I mean, you know, I'm not going to speculate on their treatment. I'm not going to speculate on what might happen to them. The Geneva Convention is pretty unequivocal in that any prisoners of war should be treated with dignity, removed from a position of danger, and sheltered and given food and water until such time as a ceasefire is negotiated.
But you were clearly very useful to the Iraqis for propaganda purposes.
Very much so. But, you know, many people might remember those pictures from 12 years ago when I was paraded on TV in a not dissimilar way to the captives that we've just seen over the last few hours. Of course, the Iraqis thought that it was good propaganda. I would suggest that their propaganda backfired 12 years ago. It garnered anger around the world that prisoners of war were being used in that way. And I suspect over the next few hours, few days, the propaganda will backfire again.
But what kept you going during your captivity? Was it the fact that you were actually known to the world because your predicament had been publicised?
Well, I'm not sure that that kept me going. I don't think there's anything that can keep you going, so to speak. I think you deal with two separate things there. You know, you say, what kept me going? Well, all control's been taken out of your hands, so nothing keeps you going. You're in the hands of somebody else, and it's up to them whether you are going to be kept going or not. So there's no answer to that question. Was it useful? I hesitate to use that word in these circumstances, that I'd been paraded on TV. Well, at least my family knew that at that moment I was alive, and it gave them some comfort. Of course, they then had no information for the next 6.5 weeks of the Gulf War in 1991. So comfort on one hand, and then unbridled fear and worry on the other.
But as a result of your experience, presumably you would urge the humane treatment of all POWs, whatever their nationality.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I know for a fact that on the British and American side, the prisoner handling procedures are firmly in place. You will see no brutality, no contraventions of the Geneva Convention on the ground in Iraq. I'm absolutely confident of that. I know many of the people involved, and I can't believe for one moment that they would treat a prisoner badly. And I would hope that the Iraqis will do the same thing. Whether they will or not, I'm sure that time will tell.
John Nicol, who was held a prisoner of war in the last Gulf War. Well, let's get some reaction from Central Command headquarters in Qatar. The BBC's Peter Hunt is there. Peter, John Nicol sounded quite shaken up there about seeing the pictures of the prisoners of war this weekend. How's it affected the spokesman where you are?
Well, it has angered them greatly, and they used a news conference to actually make this point live on television and radio stations around the world, because these pictures were briefly shown on Al Jazeera, the Arab news channel, the 24-hour channel, which became famous because it had interviews and reports of Osama bin Laden a few years ago. And more recently, that station had broadcast some of these pictures, as well as Iraqi television. And when a member of Al Jazeera asked a question at this news conference, one of the military generals made clear that he was unhappy with the station for doing it, and that he was very saddened and angered at the fact that these images had been broadcast in contravention, as you were hearing, of the Geneva Convention.
It's been a day of bad news. The other bad news has been the very fierce resistance that Iraqi forces have put up. So the military spokesmen there haven't really had a lot to put a positive spin on to the media, have they?
They haven't really attempted, actually. To be fair to them, they were speaking for about an hour, and they were honest and upfront. It has been a tough day. I think there are two different perspectives here. Publicly, they would say it's been a difficult day, but they would say publicly, and keep insisting publicly, that the overall plan is going full steam ahead, and that they will very soon be on the outskirts of Baghdad. And they are insistent, the coalition forces, the British and American troops, that they will be the victors. Privately, it is a psychological blow to have had these mishaps, to have these missing soldiers, some of whom are dead, some of whom have been taken prisoners of war, to have the marine losses they had, to have the injured, and all of this encountered by these pockets of resistance in the south of the country, and it must make them think and worry about what they may encounter when they finally get to Baghdad.
If we can stand back for a moment and, in some sense, portray a visual image of what's going on in Iraq, where are the forces? There are British and American forces moving from the south towards Baghdad. Where are they now?
I think it's quite a complicated visual pattern to create, because they are literally all over the place, and that is very much part of the strategy to hit the regime where it hurts from all different quarters. We have them moving from the south, moving up towards these area pockets of resistance in Basra around there. We have them sweeping round to other cities in the south, and we also have them moving on Baghdad, but that's just the approach from Kuwait. We've also got them in the north and in the west, and then you've got the aerial bombardment, and that is part of the deliberate strategy, the flexibility they talk about, and the primary aim of that, whether it will be achieved or not, is unclear. The primary aim of all of that is trying to bring down the regime from within, to cut off their communications between the capital and the south, and to discourage people from supporting the regime.
And just briefly, Peter, there have been these media reports of British and American forces discovering a chemical weapons factory in central Iraq. Can you tell us any more about that?
I think it's a report that we have to treat with considerable caution at this stage. It's early hours here in Qatar. All they'll say, a military spokesman, is that they're investigating a number of sites of potential interest in Iraq. The unconfirmed reports say they are suspected chemical factories. Of course, it could be a chemical factory that doesn't produce chemical weapons. There would be a great propaganda value for the coalition forces were this to be true. It would provide them with the fillip they need, and politically, it is vital. The reason American Britain went into this war, and particularly in Britain, was because they said they wanted to remove weapons of mass destruction. They haven't been found yet. They say they exist. They need to find the evidence.
Peter Hunt in Qatar, thank you very much indeed. Well, as we've been discussing, deaths from so-called friendly fire, growing casualty figures and resistance from Iraqi forces have made it a rather difficult day for London and Washington. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, acknowledged this when he paid tribute to the British forces fighting in Iraq and conceded they will face difficulties. But in an interview with Richard Jones for the British Forces Broadcasting Service, the Prime Minister said he's pleased with the military progress so far.
These things are never easy. There will be some tough times ahead, but it is going to plan despite the tragedies that have occurred. And once again, we have to thank and take pride in the professionalism, the skill and the courage of our armed forces who are helping making this country, our world, more secure and also liberating the Iraqi people from one of the most brutal dictatorships of modern times.
Now, President Bush has denounced the Iraqis apparently parading prisoners of war. I mean, what's your reaction to that?
Sometimes when people ask me, is it really necessary to get rid of Saddam, I say, look at the things that he does. I mean, parading people in that way is contrary to the Geneva Convention, contrary to all the proper rules of combat. He has mined the oil wealth of the country. British troops have managed to prevent those mines exploding, but otherwise the oil wealth of Iraq would have been destroyed. He tortures and murders people at will in Iraq, and I hope people have some idea of how dangerous, therefore, it is to leave someone like that with chemical and biological and potentially nuclear weapons capability.
Now, you've told us before about your thoughts on how military action by British forces in places like Afghanistan, Sierra Leone, have been a force for the good in the end. Now, Iraq's much more complex than that, but do you hope the same thing will happen?
The extraordinary thing about today's world is how interdependent it is, so that the tragedy of September the 11th was born in a remote part of the world, in Afghanistan, thousands of miles away from New York. If we'd allowed Kosovo to go wrong and we'd ended up with another Balkans war, we might have ended up with the whole of Europe being destabilized. Here in Iraq, if a dictator like Saddam is able to develop these weapons, is able to continue brutalizing his country and threatening his neighborhood in the way that he has, then the conflict, even if we postponed it now, the conflict when it came would be infinitely worse. And I think, you know, what happens nowadays is that we have to act in these circumstances in order to prevent the world destabilizing. And it's also important to realize that when we are acting, whether it's in Kosovo or Afghanistan or Sierra Leone or here in Iraq, the first beneficiaries of the action are the people that we are liberating, usually from brutal and dictatorial rule. And I hope people get some sense of that, that Iraq is potentially a wealthy country, totally brutalised and impoverished by Saddam.
So how full a role would you like to see British troops having once the fighting is over, peacemaking or peacekeeping?
This is something we obviously have to discuss with other allies and with other people who may come in and assist in that process. And we've got to watch. I mean, we've got a certain limit to the capability that British troops can take on. I mean, we do a fantastic job there, I think, in terms of peacekeeping. You know, we've got that facility. We do it extremely well, but we've got to be careful that we don't overstretch ourselves.
The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, in an interview for British Forces Broadcasting. Well, let's get some reaction to that interview and the events of the last 24 hours from Paul Rogers, the Professor of Peace Studies at Bradford University. Paul Rogers, we heard Tony Blair there setting out his case for war against Iraq once more. These are very difficult times for the British Prime Minister.
They certainly are. He is a little bit helped by some opinion polling that was published just a few hours ago, which suggests that there has been some increase in support for the war and some increase in support for him personally. Now, I think this polling was done before the tragedy earlier today of a British jet being shot down by an American missile battery. And it was also expected to some extent that when the war started, people would tend to rally around the troops who are out there. But there is still a very large minority of the population on the polling evidence, over 40%, who are still very dubious about the war. And if it starts to drag on and the casualties mount, then support may really slip away from Mr. Blair. In other words, there is a feeling that it is really quite soft support within Britain.
And that polling evidence, if it's important in Britain, it's clearly also important in America. Could there come a point at which it's the polls that start dictating the way in which the war is executed by Washington and London?
That's certainly possible. And in a sense, the way the conduct of the war is already being dictated, not just by British and American public opinion, but by public opinion across the world. I think this is one of the real reasons why we haven't seen the intensity of bombing of Baghdad that many people had expected. I think there's been a certain holding off and a real concentration on military targets, not least because of a fear that heavy civilian casualties would actually have an effect. And in that connection, the bombing of Basra about 36 hours ago, with apparently 100 or more civilians killed, may begin to have an impact if that gets quite a lot of publicity over the next 24 hours.
But as times grow more difficult for Washington and London, and if the Iraqis continue to put up the sort of resistance we've seen over the last couple of days, will the propaganda war then really get underway?
It really will. The one thing we have to remember, though, is that the American forces are extremely competent, capable, and they're well equipped, and they have absolutely massive firepower. Even so, the extent of the Iraqi resistance has been a surprise, and the fact that these American soldiers were killed or captured when they were running a supply convoy suggests that supply lines may be becoming vulnerable. So yes, if the war becomes more intense and rather more difficult for the United States, then the propaganda aspects will really increase very substantially.
Paul Rogers of Bradford University, thank you very much indeed. Now, we've asked six young people in the United States, Jordan and Iran to record their thoughts throughout the war. We first heard from some of them before the fighting started, and now, a few days into the war, it's time to hear more. Today, Trip Vanitas, a student in New York, who's anti-war.
My name is Trip Vanitas, and I'm a politics student at New York University in downtown New York City. And I'm going to share with you my first reaction when I heard hostilities had begun. I was walking down 8th Avenue in Chelsea in New York, and I ran into some friends who were running home, and I asked them why they were running, and they had said that President Bush had just spoken from the Oval Office because we'd begun bombing. And I went over to my friend's house, and there was a number of friends gathered. We began watching CNN, of course, and we learned that the first strike of the war was a decapitation attack on the Iraqi leadership. And I must say, personally, my reaction was dumbfounded in the fact that I expected a bombing campaign or some kind of general military war. In the past, we've never seen such a deliberate attack against a leadership target, particularly Saddam Hussein himself. And I think several days into the war now, I continue to be amazed at the events as they unfold and the overwhelming amount of media coverage, people watching these things live, the embedded reporters reporting live as tanks roll through a desert and bombs fall on Baghdad. And I'm also particularly drawn to the amount of protesting going on. I have to say, personally, I echo the sentiment of those protesters in saying, I support our troops, I support our country, but I don't support our president, I don't support our foreign policy position, and I think what's happened in the last 3 days is going to serve to undermine a great deal of future U.S. foreign policy in the years to come, unfortunately.
Those were the views of Trip Zanitas, a student in New York. If you want to follow the war in Iraq, keep listening to the BBC World Service. But you can also look at our website, bbcnews.com, and there you'll find full coverage of the conflict, including war diaries from reporters in the field, and maps and in-depth analysis of all the events as they happen. And that website is updated continuously. So do take a look at that if you want to follow what's going on rather closely. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is continuing coverage of the war in Iraq. It's almost 29 minutes past 2 GMT, and in a moment we'll have a full roundup of world news from Bush House here in London. I'm Rithula Shah.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by WOW, a boutique with artistic clothing, jewelry, and art to wear in sizes extra small to 3X. In Newton at 32 Needham Street or 617-558-1WOW. and by ColorTech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumer. Locations include Campus Camera and Kenmore Square, 251 Newbury Street, and 727 Atlantic Avenue. Arab Television is televising interviews with American prisoners of war in Iraq. To see photos and the latest summaries of war headlines, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. In the forecast, mostly clear early with increasing clouds later in the evening, lows in the mid-30s. Partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 40s, cooler along the coast. Partly sunny and warmer on Tuesday with a high near 60. Right now, 46 in Boston.
BBC World Service, this is Ritula Shah bringing you continuing coverage of the war in Iraq. American commanders admit it's been a tough day for their forces in Iraq. There's been particularly fierce fighting near the town of Nasiriyah. The Iraqi foreign minister tells us US and British troops will be defeated. And does the media's access to new technology necessarily mean more accurate coverage of the conflict or simply more pictures on our televisions? First, a summary of the world news with Mary Small.
The deputy commander of American forces in Iraq says that they've had their toughest day of fighting so far, with up to 10 Marines killed at Nasiriyah and 12 soldiers missing or taken prisoner. Lieutenant General John Abizaid said American troops had defeated an attack by Iraqi militia forces, which had initially appeared to be surrendering. Iraqi officials said 25 Americans were killed at Nasiriyah. Baghdad has again come under air attack. Several big explosions rocked the city center. An American television reporter with United States forces says American helicopters have attacked Iraqi Republican Guard units near the city of Karbala, south of Baghdad. The reporter said the Republican Guard had air defense artillery and fired back at the helicopters. The British Prime Minister Tony Blair says the campaign to oust Saddam Hussein's regime is going to plan, despite a number of accidents in which British servicemen have died. His comments came after it was confirmed that the two-man crew of a Royal Air Force plane had died when their aircraft was shot down by an American missile. The Iraqi Foreign Minister Najib Sabri has told the BBC that American and British troops will be defeated. President Bush has warned Iraqi leaders that anyone who mistreats American prisoners of war will be regarded as a war criminal. Mr. Bush condemned the showing by Iraqi state television of the interrogation of several captured Americans. President Bush says that within 36 hours, the United States and its allies will begin sending massive amounts of food and medicine into Iraq. Earlier, the International Committee of the Red Cross warned that more than 1 million people in the southern Iraqi city of Basra faced an emergency because their water and electricity had been cut off for 2 days. And reports from Washington say American forces in Iraq have reached a chemical plant south of Baghdad. Military officials told the BBC that American troops were looking at a number of sites of potential interest in northern Iraq. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is continuing coverage of the conflict in Iraq. I'm Ritula Shah. The Iraqi Foreign Minister Najib Sabri is in Cairo to attend the meeting of the Arab League on Monday. The Iraqis have asked the whole league to condemn the Anglo-American invasion. But it seems unlikely that Iraq will get that agreement. Several Gulf states, especially Kuwait, which was invaded by Iraq in 1990, openly cooperate with the US. Many other Arab countries deal quietly with America for strategic or financial reasons. The BBC's Mark Doyle met Najib Sabri in Cairo and sent this report.
We caught up with Najib Sabri in the lobby of a five-star hotel. Singers were entertaining tourists enjoying a view of the Nile. A bizarre setting for a rushed conversation about war, but the best we could get. The Iraqi foreign minister left Baghdad on Saturday morning, reportedly travelling incognito in Arab dress in a taxi. In Cairo, he was in a business suit, surrounded by armed bodyguards. We managed to squeeze through them and asked Najib Sabri first about the rumours that Saddam Hussein had been injured in the American missile attack on day one of the war.
Mr. Saddam Hussein is very well, in good condition, and he is leading our people in our fight against this colonial aggression by the U.S. evil administration and their subject, Mr. Blair.
When's the last time you saw Saddam Hussein, sir?
I saw him a day before I left Baghdad.
And could you tell us, please, you're hoping to get a unified position from the Arab League. Do you think that you will get it?
The position of the Arabs is unified. The people, the Arab people all over the Arab world are unified behind Iraq. They are supporting Iraq. They are indignant and angry against the United States and Britain. And this is pleases us. We rely on the people. There are many governments working with us, supporting us. Only the government of Kuwait, and it is a puppet regime appointed by British embassy and American embassy. So we don't care for this. These are a handful of agents, British agents, and we know them. They have been there. They and their fathers and their grandfathers are agents of British embassies. But all the Arabs are with Iraq, all Muslims with Iraq, all free people in Europe, in the United States, in Africa, in Asia, are with Iraq because Iraq is on the right.
But there are a lot of governments, are there not, sir? A lot of governments in the Gulf, a lot of governments that are cooperating with the Americans.
Puppet governments. Those are small agents. They receive their own salaries from British, American and Israel embassy. These are not governments.
Could you tell us, sir, what are the military...
The peoples of the whole world are against the aggression. This aggression is isolated. Look, where did Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair hold their own meeting? They couldn't find a safe place to hold their own meeting in their own countries. So they went to an isolated area because they are isolated. They fear the people. The whole people all over the world is against them. It is a global outcry against the policies of colonialism, neocolonialism, and war.
Could you tell us, sir, what are your military tactics now? Is it to draw the troops into cities, draw the Americans into the cities?
If I know these tactics, I will not tell you about them.
But what's the latest military situation, please? What's the latest military
situation? Is excellent. We are beating the enemy, and the enemy will be beaten and will be buried in the deserts of Iraq.
What are you going to do with these prisoners that you've got? Are you going to treat them according to the Geneva Convention, these American prisoners?
We are committed. First of all, we are committed to the teachings of Islam. We are faithful Muslims. We are committed to the teachings of Islam. So we take care of prisoners of war in accordance with our teachings of Islam.
And but not the Geneva, not the Geneva Convention,
no,
though.
We are committed, first of all, to the teachings of Islam. And second, we are committing to the conventions of Geneva in dealing with the prisoners of war. We are the people who created law. When the grandfathers of Mr. Lebrun and Mr. Bush were living like animals in the caves, Iraqis were created the law and were dealing with physics, with arithmetics, with literature, with the music. When the grandfathers of Mr. Bush were living like animals in the caves.
Could you tell us, sir, a little bit about your journey here, sir?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister.
And with that, the Iraqi foreign minister and his delegation swept past us into the marbled corridors of his Cairo hotel, no doubt to plan his diplomatic tactics for the Arab League meeting on Monday.
Mark Doyle reporting from Cairo. As the fighting goes on, there's no sign of anti-war protests dying down. One woman who's deeply involved in them is a prominent Egyptian academic and feminist, Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi. She was a member of the Commission of Inquiry for the International War Crimes Tribunal that investigated alleged war crimes by US forces against Iraq in the Gulf War. She's temporarily attached to an American university at the moment in Maine. My colleague, George Arney, asked her how she feels about the war so far.
Since even before the war, but now in the last few days, we've been having demonstrations here in Portland and people speaking. So we are really acting and participating, and the city, my students and the faculty, almost everybody here is really protesting.
Why are you so opposed to it?
I am opposed to it because it's against justice and democracy and freedom and humanity and human rights. This is not a war. It's a massacre. It's deception. It is one country going against all the nations of the world, against the UN, against the Security Council. I am happy that people all over the world are protesting, even the American people here are protesting against Bush administration.
We've been getting some incredibly graphic pictures of the fighting in Baghdad and as the troops advance. Has that affected opinion, do you think?
It increases our action because, you know, we are not really afraid or really threatened by this killing or by this military power. It's fake because even a military victory is nothing in history. This is the beginning of the collapse of the U.S. empire. It cannot go on like that against the will of the billions of people.
You were involved after the first Gulf War in an investigation as to whether U.S. forces had committed war crimes. Will you be doing the same after this one?
Yes, of course. I think not me only. I will continue to protest and to bring George Bush administration to be war criminals and to bring them to court and to judgment and to justice.
You must have heard the press conferences given by the president and the generals saying we're desperately trying to avoid civilian casualties. Don't you accept that they are trying to minimize the harmful impact of the war?
Oh, yes. I saw what the American general was speaking in Doha, in Qatar. I saw some of this on TV and other press conferences. Of course, there is a lot of deception. And there are lies. Because, you know, in the war, there is a media fight also. It's not only military war, it's media war. So I don't believe what I see on the screen. I use my mind.
Do you think all this opposition to the war around the world that you've been referring to, can it have any impact, do you think, on President Bush, on the Americans' prosecution of the war?
Of course, of course. There are two superpowers now, the American military and the people. The people now of the world are a new superpower because the UN and the security is not a superpower. But now the people, the millions who are protesting, are the new superpower. And maybe its effect is not visible now. It's visible, but maybe from the military point of view, it's not effective. But it will be very effective in the very near future.
Egyptian academic and feminist Dr. Nawal El-Sardawi. Well, those people that she was talking about there have video phones, continuous live pictures from Baghdad and reporters attached to military units, all broadcasting as they push northwards through the desert. The media coverage of the conflict in Iraq is extraordinary. But does the mosaic of individual perspectives we're getting add up to an accurate picture of the fighting? Martin Bell is a former BBC correspondent. He's seen plenty of fighting in his time. He covered 11 wars. But he's now sitting this one out as a pundit for British television. I asked him what he thought about the war reporting we're seeing this time round.
I think under the circumstances, the access has been quite remarkable. I have my doubts about the embedding of correspondence in military units, which goes beyond accreditation to incorporation. It's almost as if we have a kind of media militia these days. But they have brought us fragmentary but vivid images of what's going on, including in the last 24 hours, some frontline combat. And that is so far ahead of what we were able to do 12 years ago that I think it's done the public some service, bearing in mind that at the same time there have been non-embedded, if not uncensored, reports coming out of Baghdad. And we owe a huge debt of thanks to Abu Dhabi Television for showing us those most remarkable pictures of the bombardment.
If we look at the reporters who are embedded, the downside of that is surely that if the going gets bad for the military, then they can control the access those people have to what they see and to what, in the end, the public is shown.
Yeah, I think the test is what happens if and when the going gets bad. I mean, can they report reverses, casualties, setbacks, blunders? That's where the real test comes. But at least they are there to be faced with those tests of their journalism rather than stuck in some briefing centre back in Qatar.
But it seems in some ways that developments in the media are dictating the way in which each conflict is perceived. Because if you look back to the last Gulf War, the whole concept of rolling news was born out of that particular conflict. And this time round, we've got not only got rolling news, but we've got rolling news with correspondents all over the place, which may affect the way this conflict is then perceived.
That is true. I mean, there have been vast advances in media technology in the last 12 years, as there have been in the technology of weapons systems. But it's there, and I think one of the reasons that the media are being invited along was the stuff was going to get out anyway, and the military is trying to affect some degree of control. myself. I'd much rather they were there than they weren't, and this thing were not fought out in some kind of Dark Ages obscurity. So let me give you an example of this, of the danger. The danger is that those attached to these units sort of sign on to the agenda and the vocabulary. I mean, beware all this talk of coalition forces. What is this coalition? It's the British and the Americans. That's all it is, up at the sharp end. So I think a degree of healthy scepticism is in order.
Former war correspondent Martin Bell. A reminder of the main stories on the programme. American commanders say they've had their toughest day of fighting since their forces invaded Iraq. They've encountered particularly fierce resistance near the town of Nasiriyah. The British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has told British forces that, despite difficulties, the campaign to oust Saddam Hussein is going well. And President Bush has warned the Iraqis not to mistreat American prisoners of war. It's 3:15 GMT. You're listening to continuous coverage of the conflict in Iraq from the BBC World Service. Rolling news coverage that we were just hearing about and increased access to television means people in even the most far-flung corners of the world can watch and make their own assessment of the US-led attack on Iraq. So what do they make of it in the fabled city of Timbuktu, which, contrary to popular myth, is not a place at the end of the world, but one of the most important ancient centres of Islamic scholarship in Africa and indeed the world? Today, Timbuktu is a faded shadow of its former glorious self. And even if it's still very inaccessible, that doesn't mean its population of scholars and Islamic leaders feel in any way removed from the war in Iraq or American foreign policy. As Joan Baxter found out when she made her way to Timbuktu in the north of Mali in West Africa, people in that desert city believe their voices should carry a lot of weight on all matters concerning Iraq, Islam, war and peace.
In a Quran school in Timbuktu, about 100 children sit cross-legged on the sand, reciting Quranic verses inscribed on wooden tablets. Just as children here have done for many centuries. But the remoteness of this fabled city on the edge of the Sahara Desert does not mean the people of Timbuktu are unscathed by world events. The American-led war on Iraq comes at a time of increased American interest and also U.S. military presence in regions around Timbuktu. Late last year, the Pentagon alleged that members of Al-Qaeda were crossing freely into the vast desert north of Mali from neighboring Algeria and Mauritania. Imam Mahmoud Diko, who comes from Timbuktu, says it's all lies, and he deplores any American presence in Mali's north.
In reality, I accuse the Malian government for the American presence because they say nothing and even try to hide this American occupation of our country. The Americans go to the north, install themselves wherever they want. We don't understand why they're doing this in the north of Mali. It's to look for whom? It's just more proof of American arrogance that we see every day.
Danielle Hamilton, spokesperson for the U.S. Embassy in Mali, says the American military presence is completely above board.
The United States government has responded to requests from the government of Mali to participate in joint military training on a very small scale and secure their borders and their own territory in remote desert areas.
Despite such official explanations, people in Timbuktu say the American presence and the Iraqi war are giving rise to new anti-American sentiments that risk turning tolerant Malian Muslims into extremists. Salem Ould El Hadj is a historian in Timbuktu.
The attack on Iraq by the United States and Britain touches all of us in Timbuktu. For us, it's a war on Islam. And a voice coming from Timbuktu, a city that has so marked world history, has to carry a lot of weight.
The great civilization that flourished here gave Timbuktu many varied and diverse voices, with deep roots in both Arabic and African cultures. But the unifying force in Timbuktu has always been Islam. Abdurrahman Ben Esayuti is the imam at the Gingeri Bear Mosque in Timbuktu.
They say they're fighting terrorism, but what is terrorism but the arm of despair? Someone who will strap bombs to themselves to kill themselves and others, I say that's despair. We've always regarded the United States as the model of democracy, but with this war, where should we classify that democracy?
For many people on the planet, Timbuktu remains synonymous with the end of the earth. But people here have always considered their city a world center for Islamic scholarship and tolerance. And that tolerance, they say, is now being eroded by American military activity, not just in Iraq, but also in the Sahara Desert of northern Mali.
Joan Baxter reporting from Timbuktu. Well, let's consider now some of the day's events in Iraq. I'm joined by Paul Rogers, a professor of peace studies at Bradford University. Paul, if we can turn to something that we haven't really touched upon very much today, which is the tensions in northern Iraq. This is something that's proving to be rather difficult and rather worrying because Turkey remains very keen, perhaps, to assert its influence in northern Iraq, and President Bush has issued a very clear warning to Turkey not to send troops into the region.
Yes, he has indeed, and I think this is an area of tension which is likely to develop a lot in the next few days. With the inability of the Americans to put a major army division into northern Iraq through Turkey, what they're left with is probably quite a large number of special forces and some of their airborne troops going in to try and control the oil fields on the Kirkuk-Mosul axis and also to try and actually get some landing places and put down a degree of force which will at least tie down some of the Iraqi forces. But at the same time, you have this real conflict between the Turks and the Americans in that the Turks believe that they have the right to preempt a possible problem with Kurdish nationalism, just as the United States believes it has a right to preempt a possible threat from Saddam Hussein. So the Turks are almost using an analogous form of doctrine to the United States. The problem is, of course, that it is in pretty direct opposition to what the US would likely to see. And this, I think, is the source of the tension between the two countries.
And as if that picture wasn't complicated enough already, there are supposed to be Iranian-backed forces as well.
There are. These are relatively small, but they do seem to be fairly significant in at least one part of the Kurdish area. There is also a wider issue that the Iranians in the longer term are deeply worried about what happens if the Americans essentially take over Iraq. While they probably accept the general view that the United States would only stay in occupation of Iraq for maybe a year or so, they believe, like many analysts, that the US will put down firm roots in the form of maybe two or three major military bases so that Iran will have the American Fifth Fleet in the Gulf and American bases in Iraq. And this is something which I think is deeply worrying to Tehran. They're not going to intervene in this present war, but they're going to be really concerned with what happens afterwards.
Now, anti-war protests continue around the world. On Monday, we have an Arab League summit in Cairo. Do you think any strong line is likely to come out from that?
I don't think so, no. The earlier interview with Mr. Naji Sabri from Iraq was indicating that to some extent he was actually playing it over the heads of the Arab League leaders and aiming for the Arab populations. He does not, I think, candidly expect any great measure of support from the Arab League leadership, but he's hoping that if the war drags on, then the sheer pressure from the Arab street, so to speak, will force a wider degree of cooperation from another number of countries. That will depend very much on whether this is a war which will lead to the collapse of the regime in the next week or so, or whether it could drag on for a number of weeks. If the latter is the case, then he will be seeking and hoping to get widespread support from the Arab world, if not the Arab leadership.
Paul Rogers of Bradford University, thank you very much indeed. Now, we've asked six young people in the United States, Jordan and Iran to record their thoughts throughout the war. We first heard from some of them before the fighting started, and now, a few days into the war, it's time to hear more. Today, a US student in Washington.
I'm Vicky Vran, a student at the George Washington University Law School. I first heard that the war has started on Wednesday night around 9:45 p.m. My father actually has been calling me every 15 minutes Wednesday night to find out if the war has started, because like me, he does support the war, and he didn't have access to a TV on a Wednesday night, so he kept calling me. When I turned on the TV, all I kept seeing was pretty much the same thing, the sporadic shootings, and then a lot of people talking about whether the shootings have been successful, whether Saddam Hussein has been killed or not. I was actually pleasantly surprised that the war started with sporadic shootings first. It was nice to see that the administration was trying to kill Saddam Hussein first without having the massive destruction of Iraq and the unnecessary deaths of soldiers. Unfortunately, those actions probably were not as successful as one wanted, because the chances are that he's still alive. Hence, I was not surprised that the massive actions that everyone was expecting actually did start. Although there have been casualties so far in the first couple of days of the war, the fact that there have been some casualties is not surprising. As with any war, one of the unfortunate things that happens is that soldiers die. And, of course, it's horrible whenever even one soldier gets killed. But fortunately, so far, there haven't been as great of a casualties as there could have been. So hopefully this is an indication that the war would be over sooner rather than later.
That was an American student in Washington with her views on the war. The red carpets haven't been unrolled and the stars are having to take second place to the war. The 75th Academy Awards are likely to be a relatively low-key affair as the war in Iraq takes centre stage. Our arts correspondent Lawrence Pollard is in Los Angeles where the ceremony is underway. Lawrence, I gather they'll be cheering in the Welsh town of Swansea today.
They will indeed. If we start with the showbizzy stuff first, as you mentioned, they'll be cheering because Catherine Zeta-Jones gave them a big up, a big mention. She picked up the award for Best Performance by an Actress in a supporting role for her role in Chicago, and in a rather nice, teary, heavily pregnant sort of speech, she thanked pretty much everyone in her life, and of course Swansea, where she's famously from, all the way from Swansea to Hollywood. That means that Chicago is doing very well. They've won costume design Oscar and also art direction, so it looks like, although fingers crossed, as I said about an hour ago, it looks like Chicago is doing as well, basically, as everybody predicted.
So Chicago winning lots of awards. Anybody else got a look in so far?
Yes, there've been. And I'm sitting here with the press backstage, and an awful lot of how would you call them? Short filmmakers and animators come in, and there's kind of a buzz of not particular anticipation, and no one really wants to talk to them. But quite soon, I think, behind my back, Catherine Zeta-Jones is going to walk in. If you hear a great big round of applause behind me, then that's what that will be. But we have actually heard with the coverage as well the first few mentions of the war as well. Chris Cooper, a very very good character actor who won the Oscar for actor in supporting role, best supporting actor, very, very simply walked up to the podium, picked up his Oscar and said, "In the light of all the troubles in the world, I wish us all peace," and then walked off. And when he came to speak to the press here where I'm sitting, we obviously asked him about this straight away, and he kind of very, very clearly said, "I said everything I want to say and nothing more." And that's the first kind of mention that we've had in the actual acceptance speeches. But we have also, watching the television coverage here, had the bizarre experience of a news bulletin in the middle of the Oscars ceremony. This was a very strange thing. It was anticipated that because of the kind of the problems with tone and mood, inevitably this was going to happen. And what happened was they went to a commercial break, the commercial break ended, and then they went to ABC News and their venerable anchor, Peter Jennings, who did a very, very downbeat news update on what has been a rather distressing day for the Americans as well, with the news from Iraq. Then the news ended and it went back to the next award, which was presented by a digitally created Mickey Mouse who danced on our television screens, and the effect was odd to say the least.
Oh dear, difficult gear change there. It may be subdued as Oscars go, but we have to talk about what the stars are wearing. My producer's wildly gesticulating at me that I've got to ask you this. I would have asked anyway. What are they wearing? Is it reflecting the somber mood?
Well, maybe I should tell you that black is the new black, because that seems to be very much the... I mean, Catherine Zeta-Jones, when you see the pictures of her, is looking very stately and very grand in black. One thing I can tell you, actually, breaking news in that way that we say, that the Best Foreign Oscar has just been awarded. Nowhere in Africa. It's a German film. It was the favourite, partly because its subject matter, which was regarded as being sort of Oscar-friendly. It's about a German family, a family of German Jews, who escape from Germany to Africa, and it's about them making their new life. This will be sort of quite big news in Germany, definitely, and it's, I think, an interesting choice as well.
Lawrence, thank you for all of that. Just briefly, before you go away, are you dressed up for the occasion?
I am. I'm very, very smart in a tuxedo, a black tie dinner jacket, which I took over from Britain and which I'm proud to say I bought in 1987 in a charity shop, and it cost me about $20. The amazing thing is that it still fits as well.
Lawrence Pollard in Los Angeles at keeping up the sartorial standards of the BBC. Thank you very much indeed. This is the BBC World Service. I'm Ritula Shah. Do stay tuned for all the latest news on the conflict in Iraq.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. The BBC is distributed in the U.S. by PRI and is made possible by the Capital Group Companies, investing for individuals and institutions throughout the world, and sponsor of the American Funds Group of Mutual Funds, and by Merck, a research-driven pharmaceutical company discovering, developing, manufacturing, and marketing a broad range.